Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Cholley, bringing the best of my time today. Show Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. Happy Super Thursday Eve. It's the day before the big election day. So, coming up, Disunited Kingdom, bringing you politics from the four corners of the UK, England, Wales and Scotland. Plus, obviously, Northern Ireland, where they're having their own bit of democracy, although only 38 people deciding the new leader of the DUP and the new First Minister there. That's coming up in just a sec. But first, of course, our columnist panel. It's Wednesday, so it must be Crampon. It's Robert Crampton and Alice Thompson. Let's talk about divorce. Alice, you've written about the divorce that everyone is talking about. The slightly surprising news that Bill and Melinda Gates are parting ways, and you've interviewed them several times, and you've written about them in the Times today. What is it that you? What's your take on this? Everyone seems to have, slightly oddly, everyone seems to have a take on a couple's party.
I mean, everyone always does, don't they? So even with your friends, it's always the ones you think are going to stay together forever that then split up, and you're horrified. But I do think the first time I met Melinda, she talked about sex with Bill, actually, rather extraordinarily, because she was trying to promote contraception. So she was talking about how they both use contraception and there was nothing wrong with it. And she's rather amazing. And they both had these twin offices that were identical. And halfway through the interview, she shouted out to Bill because he hadn't gone home in time to do the children's homework. And they just seemed to have a really normal life for billionaires. So he had to do the washing up. They had to take the dog out for a walk. She was obviously quite strict about everything, but they did seem to laugh a lot together. And he was very funny at the end of the interview. And then I spent a few days with him in Ethiopia. And it was the same, actually. We were both celebrating our 25th wedding anniversary in a few weeks. And he was quite endearing about it all and about her. I mean, unbelievably nerdy. He's the least emotive person you can imagine. But in his own way, really incredibly sweet about Melinda. So it was kind of weird when it happened. I thought, God, of all the couples who are celebrities or famous or billionaires, they would be the least likely, I'd have thought, to split up.
Of all the billionaires that you know, Robert, were you surprised by this?
Yeah,
no, that's having teenagers. You spend your whole time listening to their gossip about, you know, that's all they're obsessed by, various different billionaires and who splits up with who and who goes out with who.
I didn't know Alice hung out with so many billionaires. That's what I took.
I know. They think, well, Bill and I obviously were very close going to Ethiopia. Actually, I was asked to follow him for 3 days at the African summit.
So I was amazed that given he's such a nerd that he didn't wear his seatbelt in Addis Ababa and you had to tell him to put it on. I'd have thought that's very out of character. I'd have thought he'd have.
Yeah, I was horrified by that. And also then he wouldn't, once I mentioned it finally, because I was getting quite nervous because we kept almost running over these goats.
Yeah.
Kind of, he didn't actually then put it on. And that would have caused a huge marital argument, I can say, with us.
Yeah. Yeah.
That the seatbelt discussion does go on quite often.
I don't know what I think about that. I don't know what I think about this, Matt. I suppose I just feel very sad, like most people, sad and surprised. And you sort of read the story and read Alice's account, thinking, sort of, why are you doing this? Is there something else going on? 27 years, they seemed, you know, up until, 2 years ago in Ethiopia, they seemed to be getting on pretty well, according to Alice. And so what's gone wrong? I don't buy the idea that it was the pandemic or that it's the fact that Bill's been... the conspiracy theories and so on. You'd think, I think he's probably got a thicker skin than that. So who knows? I'm just reluctant to comment on other people's marriages.
It
just seems very sad and mystifying.
We could say it's actually not sad, couldn't we? I mean, we could say that isn't it extraordinary that you've got to 27 years. I mean, that's the only way to look at it is, God, they've had three children who seem fairly normal at the moment, which is surprising. And then...
If not sad, then just weird, because okay, after 27 years, maybe I don't know, the initial spark has possibly died down a little bit, but why bother to get divorced? I mean, just live a life and I mean, they obviously get on, so I don't know, maybe it's to do with the kids growing up. I mean, the couples do that. I don't know, how old are the kids?
They, I think, are something like 18, 20 and 22. I could actually know their GCSE in the gates, I think.
Yeah. So that's kind of the classic, isn't it? The youngest kid gets to 18 and couples, I mean, some of our friends have done that. So maybe, I don't know, a bit worrying because, they seem to get on better than I get on with my wife and we haven't.
But actually, the thing that really struck me, I mean, you know, aside from, you know, their marital status, is just a reminder of the extraordinary work that they've done. In a different way, last week or the week before, we had Jimmy Wales on, who set up Wikipedia. I was joking that he was basically the only person to say, you know, he's got the fifth most visited website in the world and he isn't a billionaire trying to fire himself into space or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's at the other end of the spectrum. We've got Bill Gates, who is a multi-billionaire, but isn't firing himself into space, instead, you know, firing shots into the arms of as many people as he can, you know, and he was doing it pre-pandemic too. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is just an extraordinary thing to have done. And I know you make the point in your piece, Alice, that, you know, when you've got, whatever it is, $127 billion, you probably don't need to squabble too much over who's having what, because, you know, a fraction of that would be plenty. But just celebrating two people who had committed themselves to what actually quite a lot of people in their situation just haven't and just don't.
Yeah, that's the extraordinary thing about them, is that they've given away so much already, and that their whole life... I mean, when I went to Ethiopia with Bill, it was quite extraordinary. He was in this amazing five-star hotel. I was, of course, in the kind of two-star hotel around the corner. But when I went to see him, there was a swimming pool, a gym... you know, beautiful gardens, but he never left his office suite. He just literally spent, you know, every 10 minutes he had a different African leader in. He was just unbelievably relentless, and it started at 7 and finished at 10. And you realise that to live with someone like that is fairly astonishing. But then Melinda did the same. I mean, they both just worked flat out. They didn't go on holidays very much. You know, they didn't seem to have a huge amount of social life. And you thought they're dedicating their lives really to saving lives, and they were very competitive about how many lives they'd saved. I mean, he must be the most competitive man in the world, and he was using it to try and see whether he could save more people's lives than other people. And that, in a way, is astonishing.
I mean, what a thing to be competitive about, rather than, you know, how many cars have I got, or you know, have I sent more tourists into space or whatever. Yeah, it's extraordinary. So yeah, let's focus on the positive and leave them to their own private affairs. I wanted to discuss something else with you, which we touched on briefly on the show yesterday, but there was this social media post from Samantha Griffin, who's a cousin of Julia James, the PCSO who was murdered. And she was asking, where is the uproar about my beautiful cousin? Where's the huge outrage and pouring of despair? Where were the vigils and protests about her murder? And it sort of obviously draws the contrast, although she didn't directly, but draws the contrast with Sarah Everard and that sort of thing. And I don't really know what the answer is, but I thought it was a really interesting question. I think since that, I think there has been a small vigil, but nothing sort of on the same scale and not the same sort of national hand-wringing or, you know, introspection or debate that we had following the Sarah Everard case. I just wonder why that is. Is it just a media thing? Is it a social media thing? What do you think, Robert?
It's a very good question, and it's for the cousin to pose. India Knight wrote a good column about
this.
Yes,
exactly, yeah.
I think, and India made the point that whilst it's clear why some murders like Sarah Everard's get more attention than, if you like, the awful phrase, the kind of run-of-the-mill murder, which is somebody out, you know, which is usually somebody known to where the perpetrator is known to the victim, usually as a result of some sort of domestic abuse. But that doesn't apply in this case because Julie Jones and Sarah Everard was, if you like, similarly shocking, stranger murders. So I don't know. I mean, India made the point, and I think it's a good one, that a lot of people, the sort of people who whip up viral campaigns on social media, were able to identify with Sarah in a way that they maybe weren't with Julie, in where she lived, in terms of her class background and so forth. It would be sad to think that that were the case, but I think there might well be something in that. But I'm sorry to sound as I did with the previous subject, that I haven't got an answer to this.
But that's what's nice about having the conversation, because it's, you know, we're not trying to find answers or have an argument or, you know, sort of win it. What do you think, Alice? Is it just down to geography and a generational thing that maybe there are more young people on social media who live in Clapham with whom Sarah Everard case resonated? But I mean, there'll be plenty of people who, you know, middle-aged women who go out walking their dog. And
yes, I was going to say, she's a dog walker, and there's so many dog walkers. I mean, we know the British are absolutely obsessed by dogs, the amount of dogs we've had in lockdown. You'd have thought that would really resonate. I think it's really strange to see who gets picked up and who doesn't. And I thought it was particularly poignant with Julia Jones when she worked in the domestic violence unit. So she would have, all people know that there, you know, two people are murdered each week in domestic violence cases, and the majority are obviously women. And so it's incredibly, it's just an incredibly difficult emotive subject, that why we pick up on some and not others. And it's not just about looks, and they were both, you know, very good looking women, but it shouldn't be about that. And it isn't really, but it's also, you know, the amount of boys that get stabbed and killed on the streets in London that are involved in gangs, and some of them resonate and some don't. And I think it is incredibly sad, because if you were the family, part of you doesn't want to be caught up in a media swirl, but part of you must be thinking, why is my daughter, child, you know, mother, grandmother, cousin not getting that sort of same outpouring of grief? And it must be really, really difficult, because it does feel like you're weighing up who deserves more and who's more, you know, worthy. And I thought, actually, I always can't bear it in newspapers when they say where they went to universities, if you went to Durham or Oxbridge, or, you know, or almost in some way your life was going to be more extraordinary, because that's so not true. I mean, we should really be weighing up all lives in the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I just think it's an interesting question to which there is no good answer, but maybe it's just a bit of media self-reflection, which I'm not always terribly good at, but I thought it was an interesting thing to raise. One last thing, obviously, Super Thursday, as literally everyone is calling it tomorrow. It seems like, to some extent, Keir Starmer is trying to get his excuses in early, but I want to discuss in particular this concept of long Corbyn. I don't know if you've come across this. There's a sort of strain of people, on, particularly on social media, and I was looking at it. It seems to have been bubbling around on social media for some time, or possibly almost go back to the end of last year. But this suggestion that Labour is suffering from long Corbyn, the long-term ill effects of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, which are taking a long time to sort of shake off, which is presumably, you know, making them struggle in the elections this week. Meanwhile, you've got the Corbynistas already out and about, albeit off the record at the moment, saying Keir Starmer's going to have to resign if he loses Hartlepool. Even Jeremy Corbyn held Hartlepool and all that. I just wondered what you made of how serious do you think the effects of long Corbyn are, Robert?
I think that I hadn't come across the phrase before, but I see the phenomenon. I think Jeremy Corbyn was a disastrous leader for the Labour Party, evidently. I wouldn't think he particularly was in the northern seats that they lost as regards Brexit and as regards his perceived and I think actual lack of patriotism. I think it's probably even longer than that. I think the Labour Party is being hollowed out as a force in local civic life. I think it's been going on for years. I think they've been taking their voters for granted. I mean, I'm in Hackney, which is a Labour stronghold. We haven't had a single piece of election literature from the Labour Party. So it's not just people up in Hartlepool who feel taken for granted. It would be people elsewhere as well. And why should people keep on voting for the same party forever when they don't feel that they've been represented by them or contacted by them or really got much in common with them anymore? So I think it's yes, it's long Corbyn, but it's long something else, which I can't quite think of at the moment, it's a long decline is what it is. The Labour Party and the trade unions were, you know, they were serious local forces in many areas, particularly the Hartlepool and so on. And they just haven't been for a long time. And we're seeing the effects.
And Alex, I suppose it's partly a reflection of Keir Starmer's whether it's, you know, you can blame the fact that it's been hampered by the pandemic or just the sort of nature of the fact that there isn't a sort of big explosive zippy zingy, you know, campaign going on around him. We end up talking about Jeremy Corbyn again rather than Keir Starmer himself. That he hasn't sort of fired the imagination, and so it's all just about sort of long-term decline, his position on Brexit, Jeremy Corbyn, long-term Labour neglect, and after a year in the job he hasn't really sort of shaken all that off yet.
No, I think it's been really hard that the vaccination programme, which is fantastic for the rest of us, but that it has worked so effectively, because that is going to drive everything, that people feel that we're in a better position than most people around the world. So that's really hard on Keir Starmer. But on the other hand, he does look like a William Hague or a Michael Howard. Or it's that sense that some people in opposition just can't do it. It's very, very difficult. Tony Blair was an exception, really, in that he just knew how to have that turn of phrase. You know, sort of, you know, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. He absolutely knew where he was going and what to do and how to approach being in opposition, and it's almost impossible. But I think if I was Keir, I would be saying, actually, it's Jeremy Corbyn, because otherwise, what else do you say? You know, do you just say, look, I'm just hopeless. I haven't got any traction. You can't, can you? You're going to blame it on the predecessor.
Leaving Blair aside, even under weaker leaders, you know, Michael Foote, Neil Kinnock, Gordon Brown, Labour held places like Hartlepool. It didn't. If there'd been a mayor in the Tees Valley when they were around, it would have been a Labour mayor, or the West Midlands. You know, these are major structural shifts. Labour Party's losing its space. They've been loyal for a long time, but they're not anymore.
And I suppose the question is, because we talked about this with Danny Finkelstein yesterday, and he was saying, you know, there's lots of focus on the Tories making gains in the north, but the fact that Tories are losing places like London doesn't get talked about as much. And I think that's partly because the Tories are, the Tories are moving into new areas and making gains, and maybe it doesn't matter they're losing. Whereas Labour Party seems like they're consolidating their support in the areas where they're strong, but they're not making any new gains anywhere. And I suppose that's the question.
If you've got a Tory mayor in the Tees Valley who's just taken Teesside Airport into public ownership, it's hard to think what Labour can do about that. You know what I mean?
Maybe it's just a seismic shift. I mean, that's what I feel. Yeah. I feel that actually people haven't got allegiances in the same way anymore. And it's actually really interesting that, you know, if you talk about Boris Johnson in London now, and he was mayor there, that there is, you know, people find him really toxic. Whereas, you know, if you go outside London, you just don't get that same sort of visceral dislike of him. They are really far warmer towards him. So, I mean, maybe Keir Starmer just has to change and look around and try and get new voters is going to be the answer.
Robert Crampton and Alice Thompson then. Of course, you can read them in The Times. You just need to get yourself a Times digital subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timeswebbox. Up next, it's Dish United Kingdom. You're listening to the Red Box podcast. Now it's time for this.
From Land's End to John O'Groats, St David's to Southend-on-Sea, and Belfast to Bognor Regis. England, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland. This is Disunited Kingdom on Times Radio.
Yes, it's at that time of the week where we always get politics in the four corners of the UK, but it's a big one today. Happy Super Thursday Eve. Only one more sleep until the biggest set of elections for, what is it, half a century? Don't forget, hang your election leaflets by the fire. Don't forget to leave a mince pie out for the returning officer. And here to tell us what goodies they're expecting to find waiting for them in the ballot box at the head of their bed, Hannah Al-Othman is a news reporter for the Sunday Times based in Manchester. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Matt.
Hi, nice. Thanks for joining us. Kieran Andrews, the Scottish political editor of the Times in Scotland, obviously. Morning, Kieran.
Good morning, Matt.
Sam Cook is a presenter at Cardiff TV in Wales. Morning, Sam.
Good morning. Bore da, Matt.
Bore da to you too. And Gráinne McKinney is a senior broadcast journalist at UO5 Belfast, one of our sister stations. Good morning, Gráinne.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. Right, well, it's very exciting, isn't it, for well, at least for political nerds like us. Where should we start first? Let's go to Scotland, I think. Kieran Andrews, you've got some new polling for the Times today, the last poll ahead of the elections tomorrow. Any big surprises?
I think possibly the biggest surprise of note is the surge of the Scottish Greens, which seems like a strange thing to talk about, given that they will still be the fourth largest party. But the Scottish Greens are, of course, for their best ever result in this election, moving from four members of the Scottish Parliament to 13. And why that makes a difference is because it will really enhance the number of pro-independence MSPs after Thursday's election. It's on a knife edge as to whether the SNP will return a majority. Our poll projects that they'll have a majority of seven, but that, you know, is at odds with some others that are round about here because of the nature of the Scottish system. It's really difficult to call. This surge in Green support means that there will almost certainly be more pro-independence MSPs in the next Parliament than there's ever been before. And given how much pressure Nicola Sturgeon will then try to exert on Boris Johnson after such a result, I think that really is quite crucial.
And we had the Times Radio focus group on the show yesterday speaking to people who were planning to vote for the SNP but who'd voted against independence in 2014 and weren't very impressed by the idea that Nicola Sturgeon might suddenly whip out an independence referendum were she to be returned as First Minister this week. And presumably the same will be true of some Greens. There'll be some people voting for the Green Party because they agree with the Green Party on other issues. They want to put the environment at the top of the agenda. There's a balancing act, isn't there, particularly for Nicola Sturgeon, to take all of her support with her. There are some people who just think that she might be the best person to be First Minister and don't necessarily want to be thrown into a big row about independence next week.
Well, what opinion polls have consistently shown and what was highlighted by the focus group as well, was that there's quite a lot of people in Scotland who are very impressed with Nicola Sturgeon's performance, particular communication skills during the pandemic, and who really warmed to her, who decided she was doing a good job as First Minister, but are really not keen on the question of independence. And I think that has, you know, the SNP's internal polling and focus groups must be seeing the same thing, because we've seen their message on the constitution really shift over the course of this campaign, more towards Scotland's right to choose, and Nicola Sturgeon ever more pushing a referendum into the long grass. She's consistently said she wants it in the first half of the Parliament, so before the end of 2023. But that has now shifted into a once the crisis has passed and just a lot softer. And the Scottish Greens have been even more relaxed on a date, just saying some point over the course of the next 5 years. So there is a realisation between those two parties that people may be voting for them, but that's not necessarily a vote for independence or even a second referendum.
Yeah, and that was coming across quite strongly in the focus. Although, interestingly, when you put the suggestion that Boris Johnson might then try to block a second referendum, that seemed to, you know, that triggered a backlash as well. So, yeah, that sort of Scotland's right to choose is really important.
Yeah, we might not want it, but don't tell us we can't have it.
Exactly right, exactly right. In fact, so the BBC last night hosted the last leadership debate. Despite every leader saying the only thing they wanted to care about, they were interested in was the pandemic recovery. Obviously, the question of independence kept cropping up somehow. Let's take a listen.
And if people on Thursday re-elect me as First Minister, then I'm going to be back at work behind my desk in St Andrew's House on Monday, taking the decisions to steer this country through the pandemic. That is my priority. It's what I've focused almost every waking moment on over the past year.
But I'm on the stage saying I don't support a referendum, I don't support independence, and I want people to choose something different. I want them to choose us to focus on a national recovery in the next Parliament.
I don't want this to be the argument for the next 5 years. I do want to focus on recovery.
Well, he does not want another independence referendum when we should be united in our recovery aims. But Nicola Sturgeon's own MP, Richard Thompson, said the Scottish Government has been quite clear that the other route to that is simply to go ahead with a referendum. Yeah, that's what the SNP are saying at this election.
That's not what it says in their manifesto or in their 11-point plan.
Well, it is.
Which one is right? If the SNP have a majority after this election,
they will hold,
will there be a referendum or not?
They will hold an illegal wildcat referendum.
No, we won't.
All right.
And on it went. Before we move on to other bits of the UK, Kieran, what's your hunch? I mean, you just talked to see what the polls are. Where are we going to be once all the votes have been counted and the complicated STV system has been calculated? Where will we be? Are we heading for a big showdown and Nicola Sturgeon, big majority, and demanding a second referendum?
My hunch is that it will all come down to turnout. There's still a sneaking suspicion in my gut that the SNP won't quite get a majority on their own. I think they'll probably fall short of that, but that there will certainly be a pro-independence majority, which means that talk of a second independence referendum is not going away.
Thank you, Kieran. We'll come back to you in a sec. Let's head to Wales now, where the Welsh Parliament, the Senate, is up for election tomorrow too. Sam Cook is there for us. Sam, what's the latest polling there suggesting? What's going to happen?
Yes, the Senedd. So obviously today, the final day of campaigning, and a recent ITV poll is actually showing that the Conservatives have gained support. Now this is quite interesting because in Wales, Labour have held the Welsh Parliament for, since devolution, which was 22 years ago. The way I look at it this year, the campaign was always going to be a little bit different for all the different parties, and this year in particular, it's felt very, very low key. The only thing that really kind of comes to mind when you think about it is you walk down the street and you see all the campaigners' posters everywhere. But it's interesting this year because there is the thought that Labour could match the share of the vote that they saw 5 years ago. However, they would still lose seats due to a strong performance from the Tories. Labour has our current First Minister, Mark Drakeford. Mark Drakeford has come under some scrutiny during the current pandemic. There are some people who love him, some people who hate him. He's a bit like Marmite in that respect. And then, of course, you've got Andrew retweet Dave and RT Davis. He himself, he's promised five new hospitals and an M4 relief road with a price tag of £1.6 billion. So in that respect, kind of looking at what he's offering, I don't think it's too unrealistic. And then, of course, you've got Plaid Cymru, who are all for independence. But Adam Price himself is fighting for his own constituency in Llanelli. But they are actually down, according to my notes, they are down by 4 points. So who knows?
That's interesting. It is interesting. Just on the subject of the Conservatives, it's really, I mean, there's obviously been lots of focus on the Red Wall and Hartlepool and all of that sort of thing. But the Conservatives in the latest poll for ITV Wales has got the Conservatives on 29%. If you go right the way back to when the first Welsh Assembly elections were happening, they were on 15, 16%. I mean, the Conservatives making inroads into sort of Welsh Labour territory. That's the sort of, it goes unremarked upon in a way that, you know, Northern England, you know, there's been this sort of whole cottage industry set up analysing that.
Well, it's interesting, actually, because the Welsh Conservatives have certainly gained a little bit more support since the since the 2019 election. In that election, they actually took seats in Wrexham, the Vale of Clwyd South and Delyn. And kind of, I think that they are fighting to kind of maintain those seats. Meanwhile, the Tories themselves, obviously with the support that they're getting in Westminster, they're trying to kind of convert them into Senedd victories. So kind of, of course, we've got actually Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. He's actually in North Wales today, trying to keep those seats that he gained, that the party gained in the 2019 election. So it kind of is all eyes on whether who is going to take that glorious First Minister place.
Well, we'll find out. We'll find out when the votes have been counted. Right, having talked to Ed about a bit about Northern England, we might as well go there now. We can speak to Hanal Othman, Sunday Times reporter based in Manchester. Lots of talk about the hat trick, as it's been described, Hannah. Basically, we had three polls out this week, and so this has now become the hat trick. The polls showing that the Tories are on course to win the Hartlepool by-election and the mayoralty races in Tees Valley and the West Midlands. Obviously, no great surprise that everyone seems to expect Labour to keep the Greater Manchester mayoralty where you're there. But do you think we are putting too much focus on this so-called hat trick?
I don't know, really. I mean, the trouble with a lot of these contests is there's not much of a contest in a lot of these seats. So I think West Midlands and Tees Valley were always the most interesting ones. But I was never really in any doubt, particularly with Tees Valley. I mean, Ben Houchen's really popular. We saw, you know, the Tories gaining support there in 2019. So I don't think that's such a disaster for Labour to lose that one, because never really, in my view, thought that was one they'd win. I think really Hartlepool is the bigger problem for Labour in terms of optics, because at the general election, we had Corbyn and we had Brexit, and they were sort of given as the twin reasons why people turned away from Labour and towards the Conservatives. And both of those are gone now. So Brexit's still there, but it's not the sort of burning issue that it was, because it's been seen to be done. So I think it really poses questions for Labour. I think it will worry Keir Starmer, because it seems like this is is this an irreversible decline? You know, how do they win these voters back?
Yeah, and I suppose that's the message across the board, isn't it? You know, the Labour struggling to get even second place in Scotland, having previously won Scotland. Some questions about whether or not they're going to hold on in Wales. And I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? If Labour lose Hartlepool, there are plenty of other seats across Northern England, especially, where Labour MPs might start being a bit worried about their futures.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the thing that's happening now is Labour is becoming really sort of a party for people in cities, or, you know, that's where its voters are. And I think that's really a problem for them. You know, these Labour heartlands, as they were, are just not anymore. I think it is hard, because they are trying to appeal to these sort of young, not always young, but, you know, these sort of liberal city voters. But then also in doing that, they seem to be alienating what was once their traditional voter base. And I think, you know, a lot of that was pinned on the leadership and the political situation, but it seems to run a bit deeper than that, I think, is what Hartlepool is showing us.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Although I'm becoming obsessed with this concept of long Corbyn and the ill effects of that still harming the Labour Party, which seems to be the latest explanation.
I mean, that's interesting, actually, because I remember I wrote a piece just around Tory Party conference, and a lot of people thought that Jeremy Corbyn was still the leader. I was just doing vox pops, and, you know, it really hadn't cut through that Labour had a new leader. And the reason why they were giving for why they wouldn't vote Labour, these former Labour voters, was because of Corbyn still.
That's really interesting. Yeah. And that's, Yeah, I mean, that's the very first thing that Keir Starmer needs to do is explain that he's now in charge. Right, very quickly, let's head to Northern Ireland now. Northern Ireland not having any elections tomorrow, but refusing to be left out of the election fund. They're having a leadership contest instead to replace Arlene Foster, who's quit as the First Minister and leader of the DUP. But, Gráinne, it's not an election, is a leadership election is... Others might know it. How many people exactly are going to choose the new First Minister of Northern Ireland?
So we have a grand total of 36 able to vote on who becomes the next leader of the DUP. And I'm saying the next leader of the DUP because the two contenders, which is Sir Geoffrey Donaldson and our Agriculture Minister, Edwin Poots, Edwin Poots has said that he actually does not want to become First Minister of Northern Ireland. He's quite happy to become party leader and then retain his role as agriculture minister. And apparently, commentators have been telling us that Sir Geoffrey is much the same because he is currently he's the MP for Lagan Valley. And there are concerns that if he were to step back from that seat to become First Minister, he could potentially lose it to the Alliance Party, which would be a huge loss for the DUP. So, next Friday, 36 of the party's MPs and MLAs will vote on who leads the party, but we're not quite clear yet on whether they will choose to split the positions of First Minister and DUP leader.
If they do, what does that what does that mean? Because if Arlene Foster at times struggled to carry her party for various reasons, whether it was sort of Brexit related or domestic policy or social policy. If you're not the party leader, but you are the First Minister, how can you go into a meeting with Sinn Féin and not be the person who's ultimately going to carry the day with your own party?
Well, that's the thing. And the thing with these two men that are running, there isn't a massive amount of difference between them. The thing that they're both running on and promoting is that they want to get rid of the Northern Ireland Protocol, but how exactly they'll do that isn't really clear, you know.
That's so far taxed many minds. It's taxed the idea of doing that.
We too are baffled by that because Poots has said that he would like a judicial review, but that's already taken place. And then Sir Geoffrey hasn't said what his tactic would be to get rid of the protocol. So I suppose they're sort of wary of stepping into the exact same shoes that Arlene Foster is leaving, because they do have to be seen to come out pretty strong. They have to have a strong position on the protocol, but at the same time, the ability to work in partnership with Sinn Féin. So we're not really sure how their electorate will choose to go. I suppose a large amount of it will come down to, you know, how likable each MP or each MLA finds
personality.
Them.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I suppose that's the thing. If you've only got an electorate of 36, you can probably butter some of them up. I find it very hard to believe anyone would go into a party leadership campaign promising to do something on Brexit without explaining exactly how. That seems so unlikely. Right, in a sec, I want to ask you all for some lighter, fun stories from your patches, just so it's not all just about elections and all that. We'll do that next on Times Radio.
Times Radio with Matt Chorley.
Yes, we're doing Disunited Kingdom, where we get politics from the four corners of the UK. We've done the elections, we've done the leadership contest. Now let's have a quick whip around these fair aisles for something slightly more fun. Who's got a story they want to kick us off with from your patch?
I think, Matt, given that we're in Scotland, we're about to have an endurance race of 2 or 3 days while we're waiting for the results to filter through because of COVID restrictions. We're not getting them overnight on Thursday anymore. What caught my eye this week was Anna Rutherford, an endurance runner who beat the women's record for completing the 212-mile Southern Upwind Way by 17 hours this week, which is a fantastic achievement. But unlike most people who are used to surviving elections on copious amounts of coffee and sweeties, she got by on stock cubes to replenish her salt and energy levels, which, yeah.
That's pretty great. What is your secret to election night? I suppose if you're not actually staying up, it's not quite the same, is it? Mine was always bananas and jelly babies. What's your secret, Kieran?
Well, actually, the best one I had was in the 2015 general election, where my mum made a massive box of tablet, and I took it into the newspaper offices where I worked, and then along to a press conference the next day, where I made myself extremely popular with the other journalists who were needing a sugar hit to keep them going after 24 odd hours of without any sleep.
Which, if you don't know, it's like fudge, isn't it? For the benefit
Except
of people who don't
sugar.
Know what's tub.
Yeah.
Except with even more sugar. Exactly right. What about anyone else? Sam, how are you going to be staying awake? Have you got a fun story from Wales?
I haven't got a fun... Well, my fun story isn't about staying awake. My fun story is all about the thing that has hooked the nation over the past couple of weeks. Of course, referring to Line of Duty. For anyone listening who hasn't seen the finale, spoilers are incoming. but at the end of the series, Joe Davidson, who has been looking a little bit sus throughout the entire run this year, she was of course put up in witness protection. Now, little did I realize this house where they filmed this particular scene was actually in South Glamorgan in Wales. And I remember thinking oh, I mean, she's lucked out compared to Jill Bigelow in the last series, hasn't she? Because she had we all want to get into witness protection if that's the house that they're providing us with a wonderful dog.
With the wonderful dog, that's what I was going to say, because we've got a golden retriever as well. And I suddenly thought, maybe I've been living in witness protection. I had no idea. Maybe that's the thing, witness protection. You get given a golden retriever. That's how it works.
You must have a lovely house, Matt.
Well, I don't live in London, so it helps. So, so it means that, you know, I'm not living in a rabbit hutch. What about Hannah or Gordon? Have you got anything fun in your patch?
Well, I think everybody here is just still living in the days of having our restrictions lifted a little bit. I think I was driving around Belfast on Friday whenever our pubs were allowed to serve people outdoors, and it was a complete festival atmosphere everywhere, even though, funnily enough, nobody seemed to be getting in anywhere because the queues were an average of, you know, 2 to 3 hours long. I think everybody was just so delighted to be able to actually leave their house that they didn't mind standing.
2 to 3 hours to get a drink?
Oh, to get inside. That's to get inside and get a table. So I've heard of people waiting 4 hours is the record that I've heard so far. So I'd say... trips to the off license were most likely made while you're waiting.
That's incredible. That's incredible. I did actually realise you could go inside, because obviously in England, it's still very much outside, which hasn't necessarily been conducive to the weather that we've been having this week. What about you, Hannah? Would you queue for 4 hours to get into a pub?
No, probably not. No, probably not. No, but we've done all right up here. I think, I don't know, maybe people are less keen to sit outside with the weather, but I've not really struggled too much to get in anywhere.
Well, that's good. That's good. Any other top tips of staying up overnight for election night? Anyone? Apart from just a massive pile of sugar, which seems to be Kieran's suggestion.
I would say don't peak too soon, so with the caffeine, because this is always my problem, that you have loads and loads of coffee, and in my case Diet Coke, and then I always time it really badly and then sort of crash. So I think sort of little and often would be my recommended approach.
Well, that's it for this episode of Red Box. If you've enjoyed it, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. Maybe even leave us a rating, because it helps with the mumbo jumbo charts. We release an episode every day, Monday to Thursday, featuring the best bit of my Times Radio show. You can listen to the whole thing Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. It's available on DAB, online, via smart speaker or on the Times Radio app. If you want to read more about all of the stories we've been discussing, then go to times.radio/subscribe.